10,000 stories, 10,000 songs, 10,000 worries, 10,000 wrongs.
Good afternoon, Monterey Bay and online listeners. It's every other Sunday again. Welcome to Sustainability Now, a biweekly program focused on environment and social justice in the Monterey Bay region, California, and the world. I'm your host, Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest today is Valentin Lopez, chair of the Amamutsun Tribal Band of the Costa Noan Olon Indians and president of the Amamutsun Land Trust. The Amamutsun are descendants of the more than 20 politically distinct indigenous peoples of the territories ranging spatially from Año Nuevo to the greater Monterey Bay. All right. Are you there, Val?
I am, and I apologize for being a couple minutes late here. My apologies.
Well, that's okay. Well, welcome to the show. Introduced you. And I'm wondering, I don't think, you know, our listeners may not know much about the Amamutsun. So I wonder if we could start there talking about them. So who is the Amamutsun Tribal Band, and what is their status in the eyes of the U.S. government?
Well, thank you very much for that question, Ronnie. Well, first of all, our tribe is comprised of the documented descendants of the indigenous people of, our tribe is comprised of the descendants, we're all documented, by the way, of the descendants of the indigenous peoples that were taken to missions Santa Cruz and Mission San Juan Bautista. You know, and a lot of people want to start our history with the missions. But our history started long before the missions. The missions came to Santa Cruz in 1791 and San Juan Bautista in 1797. But our history goes back in the area. You talk to the anthropologists, our time goes back to 15,000 years. Yeah, but according to our tribe and our thoughts, we've been here forever. So there's, you know, so we've been here a very long time. It doesn't start with that. Now, regarding the status with the U.S. government, we have no status. We are a federally unrecognized tribe. As such, they have no responsibility for our tribe, and we have no relationship with them. What's really curious there and is that in 1851, they sent commissioners to California because they were getting a lot of concern and complaints about the landless Indians in California. And so they sent a commission here to negotiate treaties with the California tribes. And for California, they negotiated 18 treaties that applied to most of California Indians, including our tribe. And we were a signatory to that to that treaty. And then whenever we signed that treaty, and then the commissioner signed that treaty, and it went to Washington, D.C. to be ratified, state of California, they did not want those treaties to happen. You know, they did not want treaties. They did not want reservations. You know, they wanted extermination. And so they passed a resolution asking the president and the U.S. Senate to not ratify those treaties. And then they sent a lobbying effort to Washington to lobby that the treaties not be signed. And shortly thereafter, the president of the United States ordered that those treaties be sealed for 50 years, which they were. And so because of that reason, we have any treaties with the federal government. We have no, we're not federally recognized. We have no tribal lands. And And, you know, our treaty was sabotaged by the state of California, along with many other tribes.
Are you still trying to get federal recognition then?
You know, the federal government has developed in 1978, they developed a federal recognition process for the unrecognized tribes. Mm-hmm. And it requires 7 criteria. But those criteria are practically impossible. Very few tribes have met that requirement. And the process has gotten more and more complicated over the years. The first California tribe to get recognized was the Timbashaw Shoshone, and they were down, they're one of the desert tribes near the California-Arizona border. And their petition was 60 pages, and they were ratified. But as I said, over the years, it got more complicated. In 1992, the secretary of the BIA, who was no longer the, you know, who wasn't retired or moved on at that time, testified before Congress and said those guidelines are nearly impossible for any tribe to be recognized, including the tribes that are federally recognized today. And he recommended that those criteria be
Oops, I think we might have lost him. Maybe we can go to a quick break.
I'm here, while I'm sorry.
Are you back?
I'm here, sorry.
Okay,
I'm
go
back.
On.
I was moving to quiet some noise outside the room.
Okay.
So, and I'm done now and I'm back. So the, anyway, those criteria have never been revised. They're still impossible. Today, tribes are submitting well over 20,000 pages of documents and for their petitions. Very, very few, if any, get through the process. The last tribe to get through the process was Shinnecott out of New York. Their petition took 22 years and $88 million.
Oh, my.
Yeah, with all the lawyers and genealogists and public relations and lobbying, and it just went on and on. But $88 million in 22 years. And our tribe doesn't have that kind of money. And so we're saying until that process becomes a more likely or more reasonable or more fair, we at this time do not see that being for us.
Yeah, yeah. So how many villages were there in this area? And I pointed out that that you're associate descendants of 20 groups from Año Nuevo down to Greater Monterey Bay area. How many villages were there in that area historically?
Well, there, you know, the best number I have are 20. Those are the 20 villages. Like, say, for example.
Oh, okay, I see. Yeah.
I know that you have, in that area, though, you have tribes. You have the Quiroste tribe, which is, up there where we're working at by Costa Nova Lodge.
Mm-hmm.
And the village site that was at we refer to it as the Quiroste Valley now. That was the Metene tribe. So the Metene tribe would have been one of those village areas. But they were within the Chotoni, within the Quiroste tribe. And then when you come down below them was the Chotoni tribe. And the Chotoni tribe is where that monument is today, and north of there as well. And then when you get to Santa Cruz, you have the Uipi tribe. UYPI tribe. Uh-huh. And they were comprised of a number of village sites. And then when you go down south of that, you have the Aptos tribe. And Aptos is one of the few tribal names that we have today. And so the Aptos tribe is south of that.
So they covered fairly small territories then, it sounds like.
The villages did, that's correct. The villages did cover small territories.
And how did the groups determine, you know, what was the extent of their territory then?
Well, you know, our creation story tells us that Creator defined it.
Oh, I see.
And
okay.
That's the story. The other thing that's important to recognize here is that watersheds, the important watersheds are where our people lived. And so that right there would define a lot of tribal territories as well.
That's
a second way of looking at it.
I imagine many of our listeners have read Malcolm Margolis's Ohlone Way. And so I was wondering, maybe you could mention whether your Amamutsen and the groups were related to the Ohlone. And was there any such group as the Ohlone, or is that his, you know, someone's creation?
Yeah, I've never liked that word.
I'm aware of that, but right, that's the that's what we know.
Yeah. Well, the word Ohlone comes from the word Ohon, O-L-J-O-N. And the Ohon tribe was the tribe at Pescadero. They were the tribe north of Quiroste. And they, there was, the Spanish referred to them, the Ohon tribe, as the Ohone.
I see.
And then they started referring to everybody down to Monterey up to San Francisco as Ohone. Mm-hmm. And then whenever Cromer wrote the Handbook of California Tribes in 1923, he used the word Ohlone in writing for the first time, and he just grouped all those tribes from Monterey to San Francisco in as Ohlone. And so our tribe, we're Mutsin. Our identity is Mutsin. You know, we don't want to be identified as Ohlone because we're taking away their tribal identity. Plus, that's not where we are.
Right.
Who we are.
Yeah. Listen, Val, we need to take a quick break, okay? And then we'll come back and continue our conversation. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org on the internet. And over to you, Emily.
America, your children have an amazing superpower. They can help save lives by not having playdates. That's right. By replacing get-togethers with virtual playdates and video chats, they can help slow the evil spread of germs. And if your superheroes do go outside, make sure they continue their superhero wing by staying 6 feet away from others to protect everyone in America land. Find out more at coronavirus.gov. A message from the CDC and the Ad Council.
All right, Ronnie, back to you.
Okay, this is Ronnie Lipschitz. You're listening to Sustainability Now, and my guest is Valentin Lopez, chair of the Amamutsen Tribal Band and president of the Amamutsen Land Trust. We were just talking about the villages that comprised the area around the Monterey Bay and up the coast, and I was asking about Ohlone. So Val, maybe you can pick it up there.
Oh, okay. Well, and today everybody, that name Ohlone really impacts us today because a lot of people who say, want to claim that they are Ohlone, if they can come from Monterey or Oakland or San Francisco and say, we're Ohlone, so we get to speak for all Ohlone territory.
Yeah.
We have people coming in and claiming that territory and our traditions and our ways of doing things that are just absolutely not true. Hmm. And in Malcolm Margolin's book, I'm afraid that happened in a number of those stories where people were speaking for all Ohlone as if though they were an Ohlone tribe when there's no such thing. So,
I think it's a... I think it's a kind of a misconception because, you know, many Native American groups that have reservations have fairly large territories, and most people don't recognize the fertility of California and the sort of small ranges that the groups occupied. I think that's probably what's happening there. Can you tell us a bit about how Spanish colonialism disrupted the villages?
Oh, yeah. No, they were devastating to the California tribes, particularly the coastal tribes. You know, a lot of people think the Spanish came to evangelize in the name of Jesus Christ, and it was a sacred, holy mission that they were on. And that couldn't be further from the truth. In 1453, these other lands were starting to be discovered, and they realized that the world was a lot bigger than they thought. And the Pope at that time, Pope Alexander VI, he put out a number of papal bulls that relate to the indigenous people. And then there were subsequent papal bulls over the next 4 years that were just devastating to the indigenous people around the world. Those papal bulls said, for example, that indigenous people are heathens, pagans, and savages, that we have no soul. And having no soul is a really important one, because if you have no soul, you are not a human being. And so we had no matter what they did to us, they could whip us, enslave us, rape us, they could kill us. And it wasn't a sin because we were not human beings and we had no soul. The last papal bull in 1493 known as the Doctrine of Discovery. The Doctrine of Discovery is kind of a directive to the European Christian nations to go out and discover these lands and claim them as their territory, the Spanish, the Portuguese, the French, etc., and claim it for their countries and to turn them into Christian nations. That was their directive from the Pope. And shortly after that, you know, the Portuguese, for example, started going into Africa, capturing blacks and selling them into slavery, but they did so with the moral authority and approval of the Pope and the Catholic Church. They were just fulfilling the directives of the papal bulls. Other things the papal bulls said are that we were the enemies of Christ, that we were to be put into perpetual slavery, and that our property and our possessions were to be taken from us. So when they came into California, those missions, they came to fulfill, that last papal bull, the Doctrine of Discovery, also said that we were either to assimilate or we were to be killed. That's a really important one. We were to assimilate or be killed. And so as a result of those papal bulls, that's what the Spanish Inquisition was all about, with thousands and, well, millions, rather, of indigenous people were killed around the world in the name of the church or the name of Christ and in the name of Christianity. So that was just a horrible thing. So when they came to California, they were here to fulfill the directives of the papal bulls and not to evangelize in the name of Jesus Christ. And the true story of the missions has never been told. There was slavery. Well, people were enslaved. The person that wrote that book, an American genocide, the catastrophe of the California Indians. His name was Ben Madley. He wrote a paper last year or the year before that, that talked about the missions being the first mass incarceration system in America. And because we were forcibly captured, brought to the missions, and enslaved. And then the women were raped. Families were separated. They wanted to break our culture. They wanted to break our spirituality. They wanted to destroy our environment so we'd have nothing to go back to. And they wanted, you know, and they, you know, we were not human beings, so they just destroyed our humanity. And they were pretty darn complete about that. They were just brutal. During that period of time, well over 100,000 Indians in California died as a result of that. If you look at Mission Santa Cruz, they started going away over the hills, and they went all the way into the valley over by Stanislaus to capture Indians and to bring them to the mission at Mission Santa Cruz. At Mission San Juan Bautista, they went as far as, they went well beyond Fresno and well beyond Coarse Gold to capture Indians and to bring them. Our tribal historian, Ed Kitchum, did a count of how many tribes were taken to Mission San Juan Bautista, and 84 tribes were taken to Mission San Juan Bautista. And then in 1823, the superiors in Mexico City of the Catholic Church sent out a, they called it interrogatorios, and those are, there was a survey or a questionnaire, and one of the questions they asked is how many Indians died at the mission. And the priest there reported that 19,421 Indians died at Mission San Juan Bautista. And there was still another 10 years to go before the missions closed. So it was well, it was more than 19,421. Mm-hmm. So mm-hmm. We're just brutal to our people.
How did your particular group, the Amamutsan band, start? You know, what is its specific history then?
Well, you know,
I mean, how did you find each other?
Well, we've always been together. We did not need to find each other. We've always been together.
Oh, okay.
You know, one thing that we did. Of how do you know? A lot of people say, you know, how do we, you know? And then the mission period was followed by the Mexican period. Was nobody talked about, but that was equally brutal to the Mexican period. And then you talk about the American period, you know, that was devastating, and in particular, devastating for the other tribes in California. It was devastating for us as well. But they were paying bounty monies. They're paying militias to go out and kill Indians. In 1853, I think it was. I forget what year, 1851 or 52, 53, right in there. One of the very first state bonds, treasury bonds that was sold by California was to pay for the extermination of California Indians. You know, I mean, those bonds are passed for the public good. You know, libraries and highways and schools, etc. How is the extermination of California Indians recognized as how could it be the public good, you know? And so it's horrible times. In the Santa Cruz Sentinel, which has been around for a very long time, in 1873, the Santa Cruz published an article it was one of those small legal document article things. And it said the county of Santa Cruz will no longer pay bounty money for the scalps of Indians. It specified Modoc Indians, but it was for any Indian. They would no longer pay for the scalps of bounty money. And that's in our territory, and that's in your community right there. They were paying bounty money for Indian scalps. And the way we survived that is because when we went to the missions, they took away our Indian name and gave us a Christian Hispanic name. And we could not speak our Mutsa language or our Waswas, the Waswas of Santa Cruz. Well, that whole area there. We could not speak our native languages and we had to speak Spanish. And so whenever this time came, we just said, well, wait a minute, you know, we're not Indian. That's an insult. Don't insult us by calling us Indians. We are Mexican. My name is Sanchez Moreno. My name is Garcia Rodriguez Lopez, etc. And we speak Spanish, you know. And so that's how we survived. And then after that period, our people just lived in our tribe stayed together in tents, living along creeks and rivers and streams in the Hollister primarily area and Gilroy. And then they would travel to work the different farms and agriculture and pick the crops and stuff like that. They would pick the strawberries, and they would travel around as, you know, wherever the labor force was. They also went to the valley to pick cotton and to do the grapes. And that's how they survived up until 19, whenever the economy started to change in the 50s from agriculture, you know, to more industry, and they were selling those big ranch lands for ranchettes and housing and, you know, development. Our people had to start, you know, a lot of our people did not read or write, and all they knew was the agriculture. So many of them had to move to the San Joaquin Valley to find work and to survive. Oh. So that's how a lot of people today got to Fresno, Madera, Hanford, et cetera.
I see. Okay, I need to take another break. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org on the internet. This is Sustainability Now, and we will be right back.
Because of overwhelming weekend beach crowds that undermine shelter-in-place orders, Santa Cruz County is implementing new rules to limit beach activity during peak hours. Beaches will be closed to the public from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. beginning this weekend. At other times, beaches remain available only for recreational activities to promote physical and mental health. Walking on the beach alone or with a family member is allowed. Activities such as lying, sitting, standing, sunbathing, sightseeing, and other non-exercise related activities remain restricted. No umbrellas, barbecues, coolers, beach chairs, shade structures, tents, or other equipment will be allowed at this time. Water-based activities such as surfing, swimming, paddleboarding, and kayaking will not be affected by the order. Beaches may be traversed to participate in these activities. Additionally, facilities adjacent to beaches such as parkways, sidewalks, and trails will remain open. For more information, visit www.santacruzhealth.org/coronavirus. Residents may also call 831-454-4242 between the hours of 8 a.m. and 6 p.m. daily. Now back to you, Ronnie.
Okay, thanks, Emily. You're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz, and my guest today is Valentin Lopez, chair of the Amamutsun Tribal Band. Val, I want to shift now to some more environmentally related issues, and I was wondering if you could tell us about Jurestec, what's going on there, and what you're trying to do with respect to that tract of land.
Well, Jurestec is the most sacred site to our tribe. Jurestec translates to place of the big head, and the big head dances were our most sacred and most important dances. The people would come from all around, as far as Yosemite and the Pomo and the Chumash would come for those. And it's not only the Amamutsun that have big head dances, but many California tribes still have them, and some tribes still continue that dance today. But Jurestec was used for ranch land for many, many years, and then in the 2000s or late 1900s and 2000s, there were many efforts made to develop that. They wanted to turn it into golf courses and housing and and other kinds of development there. And they were all denied by the county because of the important environmental impacts there. Well, those environmental impacts are still there. There are protected wildlife. The waters are very important there. The plants. And it's one of the last remaining, people call it pristine. To us, it's not pristine because, all the native plants are gone and, there have some impacts. But, as far as development, there's very little development that has occurred there. And the place, and then in 2014 or 2015, there was a proposal that went to the county to do sand and gravel mining. And that sand and gravel mining was going to go at or very near where the site where the Big Head dances were held. And our tribe said that the county, we're not going to allow the county to do that. I mean, enough is enough. Enough of our cultural sites, our spiritual sites, our the important sites, coastal sites, cultural sites for our tribe have been destroyed, and we're not going to allow that to happen anymore. So we started speaking up for it, and whenever we started talking about the environmental issues concerns also, so the environmental organizations got in touch with our tribe and they joined us in opposing the sand and gravel mining effort. The company that's trying to develop that, it's an investor group that's trying to do the sand and gravel mining, and they are piranhas. They want to just, they buy the land in bankruptcy, and they want to just monetize it and then flip it as fast as they can. That's their business model. And so the land has a certain appraised value today, but if they were to get that mining permit, that would make that appraised value be 3, 4, or perhaps more times that amount. And then they're not going to develop the mine or do the mining. They're just going to sell the permit at that point and move on to the next property. But that would just destroy our most sacred site. And it's not just where the that mining area is going to go and destroy 4 sacred mountains. That whole area, all of Juristock is sacred, And our responsibility from its creator is to keep the land sacred. And our people are concentrated and focused on that area, as keeping that entire area sacred. And our, for example, our spiritual leader, Kuksui, was there at Juristock. And such. So we have an important, area going down there. Because we are federally unrecognized, there are no laws that protect us, no federal, state, or county or city laws that protect any of our traditional lands or sites. And so the only thing that's going to allow us to succeed in stopping this mining area or this mining permit is for the public to support us and to speak out about it and say that the county must recognize this area as an important Amamutsun cultural site, important sacred site, as an important environment for the Amamutsun. And then they also must recognize the environmental qualities as well, as far as the importance of the endangered species as an important wildlife corridor, because Juristock is at the very bottom of the Santa Cruz Mountains. You cross 129 there, and you're in the Gabalon Range now. So, so it's a really important wildlife corridor, and it's also an important wildlife corridor east to west from the Santa Cruz Mountains to the Diablo Range. So there's a lot of environmental concerns and interest here, but the public, only public support will stop this, and we're asking the public to stand with us, to join us.
We didn't mention exactly where it was. I mean, I have a vague idea now. but can you locate it with respect to, you know, cities and other highways?
Sure. I'm sorry I didn't do that the first time. Thank you for
I'm sorry I didn't ask.
It's at the very southern end of Gilroy, and if you know where 129 and the 101 intersect, that is to the property to the north and to the west. It's 6,400 acres, and 1,800 of those 1,800 acres come into Santa Cruz County. So, you know, Santa Cruz, this has a special interest for Santa Cruz as well.
Now, I was reading up about it, and I saw that something about the environmental impact review has been, you know, is happening or has been postponed or something like that. What's the status of, you know, what is the political status right now in the county of the permit proposal?
Well, you know, the county understands that this is a very contentious and difficult issue. And so they're trying to be very careful in developing, you know, in preparing that EIR. And well, let me say one thing about that EIR, too. You know, we were recognized, you know, there's a law that was passed in, I think, not that many years ago, 3, 4, 5 years ago, AB 52. And in California, it applies to California tribes. And that is that before there's any development on tribal lands, they must consult with those tribes. Now, AB 52 sounds great, like we're able to consult with them. But the counties, this is just a check-your-box consultation process. And they're not obligated to do anything other than meet and talk to us. So in that meeting, we asked that there be an ethnographic study completed for Eurostock to show the importance and significant cultural and spiritual values of Eurostock. And that right there, that report has been finalized and presented to the county. We did sign a confidentiality agreement with the county and with the developers that we can't talk about it. But whenever that report comes out, we will ask, you know, people to read that very carefully. Now, the status is that because they know that it's going to be probably end up in court. You know, if they give it to the, if they allow the mining permit, a lot of the environmental groups in the tribe will sue. And likewise, if they don't permit the mining permit, it will go to court based on that. And so, you know, we understand that the county is well aware of that and is doing a lot of research preparation and double checking of the draft EIR before it comes out. That draft EIR was supposed to come out in November, I believe it was. In November, but it's gotten 3 or 4 postponements, and now we've been told it'll come out at the end of the summer. And when it comes out, we are asking people to please look at it and provide comment to Santa Clara County. And then to attend the public hearings and stuff that are on this, help us voice our objection to them, and to stand with us and to stand with the environmental groups as well.
You know, maybe toward the end of the summer, I can get someone on the show who can speak, you know, more to the various legal issues around this. I was looking at the website, the Land Trust website, and I saw that you also sponsor something called the Native Stewardship Corps. And, what is that?
Yes. Well, you know, our creation story tells us that Creator gave us the responsibility to take care of Mother Earth and all living things. And so for thousands and thousands of years, our people actively stewarded and took care of these lands. They took care of the plants, the the waters, the animals. They had a lot of ceremony to keep the land sacred. They had ceremonies to call back the salmon, call back the migrating plants. We used fire as a management tool for the landscapes. The coast, the central coast there of California, in Santa Cruz, north and south, that right there at one time was a coastal prairie. It was not what you see today. You know, all these trees coming in, you know, and all those shrublands and everything else. And then they were not part of the landscape of California when those missions and the Spaniards came in. I know that those early explorers coming in on ships, they wrote that it was a beautiful landscape and it was a park-like setting, et cetera. But everything was maintained and managed by fire. Our people would use fire to keep all those encroaching plants and shrubbery and trees out, and then we kept it as a very important grassland. And those grasslands and everything area, was recognized as the most biodiverse landscape in North America. So that was a very, where you are was a very biodiverse area, and it looks nothing like it was today. But that was because of our stewards or our ancestors stewarding the land. And so that's what we're trying to bring back now. In 2012, we developed the Yamamoto Land Trust, and there's four goals for our land trust. One is to do research to restore the indigenous knowledge of our ancestors. The second is to provide education to the public and to our tribal members to relearn that knowledge, and then to fight to protect our culture, the few remaining cultural and spiritual sites of our tribe. And then the fourth one is to return to our tradition of stewarding the lands. And so today we have a stewardship corps of 9 stewards. We just hired 2 new ones. Who will be working to restore the coast. You know, they're all certified firefighters, and they are certified on chainsaws, and they're working to restore that coastal prairie. Currently working on a project, in a state park area there. It was a traditional site to cut down trees and to restore the native plants. And so that's one of the projects we're currently working on. But, so our stewardship corps is to restore that tradition. And their job is to regain that knowledge and to pass it on to future generations and for us to continue learning the stewardship knowledge of our ancestors and the contemporary stewardship so that we can effectively manage in a traditional way our traditional lands.
All right, we need to take a quick break. You're listening to KSQD 90.7 FM in Santa Cruz and KSQD.org on the internet. Over to you, Emily.
Thanks, Ronnie. Tune in to KSQD this Sunday for State of Mind, hosted by Santa Cruz licensed psychotherapist Deborah Sloss. Deborah's guests are Judith Ein and integrative medicine specialist Dr. Cynthia Quattro. They discuss the tick-borne illness, Lyme disease, and the mental health effects associated with this. Judith shares her personal story of deteriorating health before her diagnosis and what the treatment and long-term symptoms are. Despite discouragement and fatigue, she now manages her symptoms and contributes to her community. Dr. Quattro offers information about the bacterium that causes Lyme disease and how to access diagnosis in integrative medicine from treatments with extensive experience with Lyme disease. Join us for new understandings and seeds of possibility on State of Mind, Sunday evenings at 6 p.m. here on KSQD 90.7 FM and KSQD.org. Back to you, Ronnie.
Okay, that's coming up in just about 15 minutes. You're listening to Sustainability Now. This is Ronnie Lipschitz. My guest is Valentin Lopez, chair of the Amamutsun Tribal Band. And we were just talking about the research goals of the Amamutsun Land Trust. And I was wondering, Val, if you could also talk about the relearning program at the UCSC Arboretum that's run by Rick Flores.
Yes, thank you. We're very happy and proud of our relationship with UC Santa Cruz and with the Arboretum and of the Arboretum. They developed a garden there. We were talking to them one time in the early days, like 08, 09, and telling them that we're working to restore the native stewardship gardens. And our native knowledge. And they said, oh, you know, let's, how about a garden here? It was their idea, actually. You know, how about having a relearning garden here at the Arboretum and stuff? And we just said yes immediately. And now they have a 54 or 55 acre relearning garden, and it's teaching us to take care of our medicine plants, our food plants, our basketry plants, and our plants for other uses. And our people can go there and gather as needed. I know I've collected food, seed plants there on a number of occasions, and our people regularly go there as well to collect resources, and in particular the medicine plants for ceremony. And it's a wonderful program where people go on there and work with the plants and work with the people, with Rick and with others at the Arboretum, you know, to keep to manage that garden and maintain it. And it's turned into a wonderful program. And it's relearning, but relearning isn't just for us. It's relearning for the public as well. Because, you know, what I say is there's not enough amanutin now to restore Mother Earth and to restore our landscapes to what it was before contact. We need a lot of other people to get involved. We want to restore our native plants. So they can go to the Arboretum and learn about our native plants and stuff like that and what would work in this kind of, you know, at this location and with these kind of conditions, et cetera, and they help with that. But then they can also learn about our native plants as well. And then we have regular what they call them, work and learn parties, where people can go there and work at the Arboretum for 3-4 hours and help us, you know, maintain the relearning garden, the native garden. And then we'll have lunch, and then in the afternoon session, we'll have tribal members talk about how to do traditional. Well, I know we've done weaving, we've done bead making, making salves with our medicine plants, and et cetera. So it's a wonderful program, and we ask people to go there when they want to find out more about traditional native plants, or they want to find out more about our traditional ways, and that's a good place to go. So happy with that relationship.
Is that information listed on the Arboretum website? I mean, it's closed right now, but can people find out about those sessions by going to the website, or is this somewhere else they have to look?
No, the Arboretum website would have it, but plus our Amamutsun Land Trust, you can sign up to receive our newsletter, to sign up as a volunteer, or to receive updates, regular updates from the Land Trust on upcoming activities of the tribe and of the Land Trust.
Okay, well, I'll mention that again at the end of the show. I wanted to ask you, you know, we're getting close to the end of our hour, but I wanted to ask you about how the pandemic is affecting the members of the tribal band and what people might do to help them.
Thank you for asking that question, Ronnie. Our members, many of our members, you know, now have traditional jobs that you would recognize, and so their treatment is pretty much the same. But we still have members, you know, who live in difficult circumstances. And I know we put out an ask on Facebook to see if anyone needed food as an example, and we got six requests, and we worked with Pie Ranch to get vegetables from there, and one of our stewards drove over there, got it, and then delivered it to those members, and the members were in Modesto, Madera, Fresno, and Hanford. And two of those persons were very elderly and in wheelchairs who needed assistance. And other members needed assistance as well. And we knew that our tribe had a responsibility to help take care of them. And so we started a GoFundMe page asking for donations so that we can better take care of our tribal members who are affected by the virus, mm-hmm. and to help us, and so we can, you know, so that we together can help them with food or with transportation or with medicine, et cetera. And so our tribe has developed a committee to review the requests from our tribal members and to make determinations on how best we can assist them. But we do ask if people would like to help our tribe to be able to better take care of our members during this difficult time, to please go to our GoFundMe page and to make a donation.
Yeah, I got an email message the other day about it's called the Amamutsen Family's COVID-19 Relief Fund, and it is on GoFundMe. And the request is that listeners might contribute part of their stimulus check from the U.S. government to the fund. Okay. And contributions are tax deductible. So, listen, as we're closing, how can people find out more about the tribal band and the land trust and volunteer opportunities?
Okay. Well, thank you for asking that. We have on the Eurostock campaign, which is our top priority right now, we ask people to go to our Eurostock website. It's at protecteurostock.org. And Eurostock is spelled J-U-R-I-S-T-A-C. And there's a lot of information there about what the issues are, what the environmental concerns are. I spoke at the United Nations on this topic in 2018, and the recording of my talk is there. There's just a lot of information there, and people can find out a lot about it. What we ask you to do is go to our Protect Eurostock website and sign the petition, and then send that petition to to your family members, to the people in your social group, to the people on your social pages, your Facebook page, et cetera. Help us get that message out and ask them to sign the petition. Then they can write letters to the county and ask them and tell them the Amamutsen tribal band, that territory, its traditions, its culture and spirituality must be protected. And then whenever the draft EIR comes out, please review it. And if you have specialties in any particular area, pay attention to that area. Provide technical comments on those areas. It could be on the water. It could be on the wildlife. It could be regarding the corridor, the wildlife corridor, or on the plants. But you know, please provide comments. Or, again, just a general comment. After the draft EIR comes out, I'll provide that to the county. And then other ways you can help are go to the Amamutsen Land Trust and sign up for our newsletter. We certainly, you know, our newsletter, there's a lot of information that comes out on that. And read that to keep up with what we're doing. And I know that right currently we're trying to develop the capacity to handle more volunteers, because our capacity is growing, and we're getting a little bit more funding to help us in our work. And so we're going to be able to do more. And so we're going to be asking for more volunteers to help us. So if you'd like to help us, you can sign up as a volunteer at our website. I know that one of the bigger projects we have coming up is we need to plant approximately 40,000 native plants in one of the landscapes we're going to. And that's coming up, you know, we'd probably be planning about right now. It wasn't for this COVID illness, but we're going to be planning that as soon as we can get back to work. So that's just an example, you know. And then other things are just, you know, we say that we want the truth to be told about our history and all indigenous history. So help get the truth out there about the indigenous history. Why isn't the truth being taught in schools? You know, you heard about that, the treasury bond passing to exterminate Indians. Why didn't you learn about that in high school or college? You know, and then paying the bounty money and paying militias to go out and kill Indians. Why isn't that in there? You know, the slavery and the brutality of the missions. You know, it's just all been lies and cover-ups. So help expose that. And then the environment.
Okay, listen.
The environment. Thank you.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you so much, Val, for being on the program. 2 weeks from today, my guest will be Ann Lopez, director of the Center for Farmworker Families in Watsonville, and we'll be talking about farm workers in the Salinas Valley and their needs and how they're being affected by the pandemic and other kinds of issues. That'll be on Sunday, May 17th, 5 to 6 p.m. right here on KSQD 90.7 FM on your dial and ksqd.org. By the way, these shows are being rebroadcast on Tuesday mornings from 6 to 7 a.m. if you get up at that time. And you can find past program broadcasts on archives at tinyurl.com/RESD6JB and on the KSQD website. So until next every other Sunday, sustainability now. And thanks very much to Emily Dunham, who is taking care of engineering at the station.
Ten thousand songs.